Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In this first hour, we'll be talking about Russia, current events in Russia, and about relations between Russia and the United States and Europe. Our guest is Mark Steinberg. He is professor of history here at the University of Illinois. He has written extensively on the history of Russia. He also served between 1998 and 2004 as the director of the Russia and East European Center here at the University of Illinois. And we're glad to have him here with us to spend a little time talking. Questions, as always, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. That means anyone may call. And if it's a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And locally here, 333-9455. At any point, people can call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many as possible. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. I look forward to it.
Maybe as a way of starting, I'd like to talk a little bit about the upcoming summit, the G8 summit that will be taking place in maybe about 2 weeks in St. Petersburg. This is a group that, until Russia was added in the late 90s, was the group of seven, and now is the group of eight. And I think that at the time there were some people questioning whether or not it was appropriate to add Russia. But this is the first time that Russia has ever hosted that is taking place there. Just how significant is the fact that it's happening in Russia? How important is that, say, to Mr. Putin and to the Russian government?
Well, there's two things about it. One, that it's in Russia. The other, that it's in Petersburg and not in Moscow. That Russia's included, is hosting it, that Russia was included in the G8 as opposed to being G7 plus one, which it was for a while, mm-hmm. where Russia was sort of sitting around feeling half present, is critical because probably, well, one could say even before Putin, certainly under Yeltsin, even under Gorbachev, the notion that Russia has to be a member of the community of nations, especially European nations, which they generously include the U.S. as European because of U.S.'s enormous presence, actually, in Europe, but they always use the phrase European, is part of the notion of what it is, what the future of Russia entails. And in fact, the idea that Russia wants to be, as it has for some time, but periodically sort of set itself apart, wants to be part of Europe, is actually one of the more promising directions ideologically, if one wants to call it that. And then, of course, that it's in Petersburg is actually fits very nicely. Peter the Great, of course, created Petersburg to make Russia, which was very isolated and very Asian in some ways, to really make Russia part of Europe. Mm-hmm. And so hosting it in St. Petersburg is partly, of course, that's Putin's city. He has personal feelings about it. There are nice palaces. It's elegant and grand. But Moscow is really where things are happening in Russia. So in a certain sense, to invite them to the old capital is a highly symbolic gesture.
Yeah. Russia, I think, it recently has been flexing its muscles, at least in an economic sort of a sense. Mm. And the muscle that it has is energy. It has oil and natural gas. I read recently some references to Russia becoming or being an energy superpower. How is the Russian economy doing?
Big question. The many, many million ruble question, one might say. You know, it's interesting because the energy superpower is absolutely true. I mean, the economy has really thrived in the last several years because of the inflation of prices of oil and gas. And some economists will argue that the biggest problem is that the Russian government is poorly using the windfall. They're saving lots of it in case of a disastrous emergency. There was a terrible crash in the economy in 98, and they want to be protected against that. So there's a sense that they're not actually investing it adequately. But the Putin government certainly insists that they're fully aware of that critique, that they're moving in a careful and calculated way, that they're trying to use the money. Of course, that reminds us that a lot of industry is actually state-centered. State-controlled or state-owned or owned by people very close to the state, which means in a certain sense that as oil and gas revenues are reinvested in the economy, they're reinvested, of course, in the state sector because oil and gas is controlled by the state. So this is state money. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is the state sector, as the economy improves, it becomes more state-oriented, which is in a long Russian tradition. That was how the imperial government under the czars actually also developed the economy. And then, of course, the Soviet period was entirely state-centered. So one could be concerned that even as things are going well, and even as they're investing the money, it's becoming a more state-centric and less, one might say, free market economy, or free market in the sense that private and independent entrepreneurs are controlling wealth.
I think there's also, at least in some of the things that I've read, some concern that while it is true that Russia has very significant energy resources, oil and gas, that it may be overextending itself in the kind of commitments that it's making to provide energy, particularly to China, to Japan, perhaps also to Europe. And there's some question about whether they're over-promising.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's two sides of it. I mean, one is in terms of the long term and the agreements that they're making. Obviously, selling natural resources is critical because just using them internally isn't going to get them any income. And in that sense, they're very investment-oriented or capital benefit-oriented. So they're thinking in capitalist terms. You want to sell your valuables. You don't want to use them. But what that means, in another sense that they're overextended, is that domestic energy problems are constantly present. So you find shortages. You find prices being higher than Russians think they ought to have to pay, given their low incomes and the availability of resources. You find distant places that really don't have adequate energy supplies to ordinary Russian users. So they're very much in a mode that's been also I hate to get into the long Russian tradition, but there are models for these things. At times of earlier, for example, grain was once their greatest resource. Grain shortfalls, they would continue to export because of the desire to have income. Stalin actually did that at a time when he was exporting, but it also happened in the imperial period. So they're continuing that policy. Better to export, get the income, and don't worry about the long term, and don't worry about domestic consumers.
Yeah. And it also seems that for them, that energy, is their ability to supply energy, is their leverage, particularly with Europe, but perhaps other countries as well. That's their stick.
Yeah.
And once you get people dependent on that supply, then the suggestion that you might turn off the spigot is going to be a powerful tool that you can use if you're having some dispute about something that has to do with something else entirely.
Right. And there's enormous suspicion of how Russia behaves in the world economy. And this is one of the aspects of G8 that's so important, because it means Western countries are there to have conversations about purely economic issues, not human rights issues, not other issues, but about how they're going to behave in the world economy. And Russians are a new player. People are very suspicious. And two aspects of that are interesting from the last couple of days. One is Gerhard Schroeder, the former chancellor of Germany, recently made a statement, and he said, absolutely, under no circumstance will there ever be an interruption of gas supplies from Russia. And it was clear that Putin and he are good friends. They talk on the phone. They're great allies. And this was in a way Schroeder being Putin's representative in Europe, saying he's going to tell you, because he's a European and you'll believe him, something that is essential to us, which is we are trying to convince you we will not use oil and gas in political terms. Trust us to behave in rational economic terms, unlike, he's implying, the Middle East, where you just never know. Mm-hmm. We're good suppliers. Whether that's true or not is another question, but certainly they're trying to convey that impression. The other is there just was a famous, I guess it was today that or late last night, that a steel company merger fell apart. And this was a European steel company merging with a Russian one, which Russians saw as an important example of foreign investment in Russia. And they were very hoping that it would happen. It fell through. An Indian company is going to merge with the European company instead. And there's been discussion all over Europe. What does this mean? Russians said it shows people don't trust us. People are prejudiced against us. And so, again, a leading Western European economist who's close to Russia said, you know, Russians think just like Western European businessmen. And again, he may believe that, but certainly he's saying something the Russians have been trying to convey. I'm not in a position to predict the future and say whether one can trust them, but I would say they're bending over backward to say, you know, we're going to behave in the way you Western Europeans and Americans think we should behave and do behave in the economic environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a little more distrustful than perhaps we should be.
Well, I think that this issue of trust or lack of trust is an interesting one, because I think that even though it has been a number of years now since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the beginning of this era of greater cooperation and understanding and friendship, that it seems that yet we in the West, in Europe and the United States, remain just a little bit suspicious of Russia. We're still not so sure about them. And in that sense, it seems that we have not completely moved away from the mindset of the Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just a little bit suspicious is a gentle way to put it. In the last couple of days, and as this, in fact, this morning, I noticed that as this steel deal fell through, one Western European economist said, you know, we really do in the West have a tendency to view Russia still in comic book terms. And that's a long history. There's an early 19th century czar who said, our main task is to convince Europeans we are not bears. And, of course, the metaphor of this image of Russia as a bear has lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. Russians tried to play with it during the Soviet Olympics, where they had this little Misha bear, a cute, cuddly bear, as their symbol, which was really a play on this classic symbol. And it's true. We now, you know, in Soviet times, they of course, we had all sorts of comic book Cold War images of them. And then still today, it tends to be we think of mafia, we think of corruption, we think of bears, actually, still, and this sort of frightening, ominous image. Not without some reason. I mean, it's important to say that Russia is very conscious of its size, of its history, of the need not to simply be a good ally and friend of more powerful countries, but they believe they are and always and should be a superpower. And that means an equal among the great nations. Hence, again, to go back to your first question, G8 is the club they want to belong to because of its symbolic value in part.
Our guest in this hour, Mark Steinberg, he's professor of history at the University of Illinois, specialist in the history of Russia, and we're talking about current events, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think people certainly will remember back to the story of the first years after the end of the Soviet Union and the move toward a capitalist economy. The story was that a small number of people who had the opportunity to cash in did. Mm. And some people got very wealthy very quickly. Some people, probably not some, but a number of people really lost ground, particularly older folks. And then we have this group in the middle that maybe is indeed not – hasn't gotten rich but also – is not living in abject poverty. How are people doing in Russia? And I suppose the question is, well, that depends on who it is that you're talking about.
Yes, indeed, it does depend. I mean, exactly right. I mean, there is this moment of what – it's one of the reasons that some people like to speak of post-communist Russia as an example of crony capitalism, in which those who had very good connections were basically given – the largest state industries, although many were kept in the hands of the state or in very close allies of the state. And people who were members of the Communist Youth League, officials in the Komsomol, like Khodorkovsky, who unfortunately for him is now in jail because of the attempts to limit some of the corruption, but for other reasons as well. I can talk about him later. People who were members of the Communist Party, people who already were managers in state industry, were basically said, you take this in a fairly blatant fashion. And so you have some of the richest people in the world. You have, of course, the other group you mentioned, retirees, who can't work. I mean, they're not in a position to really work, and they depend on pensions, which are abysmally bad given the incredible inflation, as well as all the new products that you can find in the market. And that leads to the sort of question of the middle, because as the economy's improved, as there are more things in stores, which tend to be sold at Western prices, for those people who are able or willing – and there's always a degree of chance as well as skill in these things and youth to find new jobs. And I mean it by the plural because many people work multiple jobs. The notion Russians don't work hard is a fallacy. They often hold many, many jobs to do well. Some of them are there is the emergence of what might be called a middle class, though they work much harder than most middle classes need to in order to be able to achieve, to be able to buy the sort of products that are on the market. On average, every poll, every economic study agrees the majority of the population, and that's especially true outside of the big cities like Petersburg and Moscow, are worse off now than they were under communism. And that has all sorts of political ramifications, obviously.
We have a caller here. Why don't we bring him into the conversation? Someone listening in, Eureka, and this is on our toll-free line 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning. I'd just like to check out two assumptions. One is, though America's love with a kind of laissez-faire capitalism and belief that maybe in post Soviet Russia that it would seem how flower and take bloom, it always appears to me that the masses have really had a great distrust of kind of free and open market capitalism, and as you say, no matter what we think, they always seem to go toward a more state-directed economy. Could you give me your opinion on that?
Well, if I understand your question to be the sort of issue about laissez-faire capitalism, one thing to realize is, of course, as you probably know, after 1991, when the Soviet Union fell and there was a decision to go in a much more rapid direction of economic reform than even Gorbachev was already considering, who was trying to mix limited markets with state control, that all sorts of advisors from especially the United States, but IMF, World Bank, various world institutions, offered them a sort of ideology in which they assured them that laissez-faire capitalism, which is to say freeing up everything in an economy that had been very state-controlled, freeing up prices, freeing up the possibility of buying into industry, creating an instant free market, would work very well, that the economy would thrive, that the people would benefit. In a matter of, at the time, I remember economists saying, 5 or 6 years of very difficult transition, then all will be well. And all was not well. All is still not well for the majority of people. And one can argue that the economy ended up going in two directions which were not productive to the image of what was dreamed of by ideologists of quick laissez-faire capitalism. One direction is a corruption, where individuals took advantage of that and created small little empires of their own and great personal wealth. And the other is, of course, state recontrol of large parts of the economy to sort of try to reimpose a type of order. And that led to, of course, a criticism by Western economists, say, well, you didn't listen to us closely enough, that, in fact, you should have gone faster, which meant every time the Russian government found massive unemployment, hunger looming, the threat of disorder, and tried to somehow back away from that by reintroducing control, Western economists said, well, that's why things have not gone well, because you're afraid to really let loose the economy and all of the sort of magic of the marketplace. And it's true. I think there are many in the West who have a sort of almost, true believer faith in what the marketplace could do. And, of course, we can't really know whether they're wrong because everybody was frightened by the immediate effects of free market capitalism. The other, of course, is the attitude of the majority of people. They were raised in a welfare state. And, in fact, I think it's more useful to think of Soviet socialism, especially in the post-Stalinist years, which is what most people have experienced, as a welfare state, a state that promised them security, promised them decent pensions, promised them jobs no matter what they did or how badly they worked. And this was, you know, most people would probably like such a system, in fact, not just Russians, but certainly that was part of the life that they knew. And suddenly to be told, you're on your own, sink or swim. And, of course, most were sinking given the conditions of the economy where there were few opportunities. It's not surprising that actually every poll shows that the majority of the population think they've lost more than they've gained by capitalism.
So it would be accurate to say that most of them do favor a kind of statist approach over against the free market, I mean, in terms of the opinion of the
It's statist in the sense of state. They don't mind markets. They don't mind private investment and private ownership. Mm-hmm. What they want is the state to place an active enough role to ensure the welfare of the population. And, of course, needless to say, that's what we have in the West. And we don't have laissez-faire capitalism, I think one could argue.
I think maybe one instability. The second one would be, it seems, though, again, though we have this kind of maybe ivory tower view of democracy, it seems from what I've heard by various authorities that the Russian people favor the more iron and stronger hand the Putin takes in terms of keeping order and maybe maintaining a kind of stability of law and order, he tends to thrive in terms of popularity. Could you react to that?
I would say it's not exactly true. Judging by my own experience and talking to people, which is obviously rather anecdotal, but also based on polls, which are relatively scientific and nationally have very good polling institutions, it's not really true that Russians don't believe in democracy. They believe the people should influence the state. They believe that there should be a thriving civil society in which they can join what organization they want. They could read news that will give them a sense of information to help them make decisions. They believe in the dignity and fundamental rights of individuals. That is clear. What is complicating that is, what do they mean by democracy? And what they mean by it, the majority, apparently, based on most evidence, is a democracy that is not a disorder. So the notion that democracy and freedom means such liberty that anybody can do anything is something that troubles them deeply. Russians have a very strong moral sense, for one thing. And again, polls show that they believe that people should act ethically. And how do you ensure people act ethically? Well, ideally, everybody should have an ingrained moral consciousness. And Russians are inclined to say it should come from their conscience and from their religion. But they believe that in the absence of that, the state has a very important role as a regulating function. The actual term that the government has begun to use recently itself, and some scholars think is actually a good description, is managed democracy. So you have democracy.
Okay, this is WILL Urbana. It's Focus 580. My apologies there for the interruption. We are having some work done on our tower, on our AM tower, and we knew that this was going to happen. We weren't exactly sure what time it was going to happen, but we knew this was going to happen. So we have reduced our power, and that means that perhaps some people who were listening before can't hear us anymore. But at this point, certainly people around Champaign-Urbana should continue to be able to hear us, and we'll continue with our conversation. Maybe again, I should introduce our guest, Mark Steinberg. He's professor of history at University of Illinois, was also director between 1998 and 2004 of the Russia and East European Center here at the University of Illinois. And we are talking in this part of Focus 580 about Russia and recent events in Russia. Now, I'm sorry, you were in mid thought there and you had to stop. So if you can pick up roughly where you were, you can get back to the question.
I don't know if the listener's still around, but in any case, the question was about democracy and to what extent Russians believe in democracy or what extent they want the strong hand of the state. And the notion of democracy is, of course, critical, as I was saying. But Russians believe, the majority of Russians, based on polling data and their voting patterns, actually, the type of parties they tend to vote for, want a democracy that is, as the government likes to call it now, managed, mm-hmm. which is to say that it supposedly avoids certain forms of corruption, which it hasn't managed very well, so it's not really managing it well, prevents abuse of rights, and it hasn't done a very good job of that. And some people would argue that actually they've done more management than democracy, and there are a number of problems on that front.
When Mr. Putin ran for re-election, I think this was in 2004, right? He got 70% of the vote, what has been described in stories that I've read about it as a landslide victory. Mm-hmm. And the Constitution says you can't have more than two consecutive terms. But also, I read a lot of articles where people are speculating that he might want to run again so that either the Duma might change, they could change the Constitution, they could declare some sort of a state of emergency and say, this is no time for us to change leadership and ask Mr. Putin to continue. So there seems to be some suggestion that enough people would want him to continue to be president, he would want to continue to be president, that they would find some way for him to continue to be president, even though the Constitution says he would at least have to sit out for 4 years. So I guess I'm thinking about, if people are unhappy about their economic situation, if they're unhappy about lack of democracy, do they blame Mr. Putin? And, if not, who do they think is responsible?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because while the economy is doing very badly for the majority of the people, it keeps doing slightly better. So there is this very incremental improvement, and that gives people hope that that will continue. So there's also no alternatives. And it's important to recognize that part of Putin's popularity is that there aren't real serious alternatives. I mean, the communists basically, to the extent they're an alternative at all, are really offering very much the same thing Putin's offering, which is to say continued market development, continued limited democracy, and strong welfare measures, things that Putin is trying but very gradually to do. What people like about Putin is that there is gradual progress, which keeps a glimmer of hope. There's a lack of serious alternatives. And he's very stable. I mean, one of the things he said when he first came to office the first time in 2000 is that, which is, he was after he was sort of appointed by Yeltsin, is that we've had so many revolutions in Russian history. I promise you, no more. No more revolutions ever again. And given what Russians have been through, that actually is very appealing. He's very popular because he provides a type of stability. He also pushes all the right buttons, buttons of national pride, buttons of be concerned with the poverty of the country, crack down on corruption. It's not clear how much he's done that. But he certainly talks a very good line, and the basic economic conditions are incrementally getting better. So then comes the question, what will happen in 2008? Mm-hmm. He has, and of course, his poll numbers are, I mean, any world leader should have poll numbers like him and would be delighted. And so it's always a good challenge to explain why is he so popular. It's probably one of the best questions you can ask about Russia today. In 2008, he has insisted he will not run again. He will not change the Constitution. And the best reason he offers for that, besides the fact, you know, just sheer modesty and that's the law, and he always said all along, and you should believe what I say, is that this will really be the only second time you can really prove if Russia's a normal country. Can you have a normal transition of power? And if the country says, here's our opportunity, according to law, to elect a new president, and the country says, by acclamation, we want to keep Vladimir as Tsar, which is what it would almost imply, there is this strange sense, quite right sense, in his mind, this would not be a good symbol about Russia's ongoing progress. Now, there's enormous popular pressure on him to stay, to change the Constitution. He opposes it again and again, and for just those reasons, mm-hmm. that a normal transition is very important. His power after being president will be considerable. He's not going to go away, even if, just because he's not going to run for president. He will be closely kept, as it were, in the court of those in authority.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other callers, and I think we'll go to Indiana, I believe. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. Well, mm-hmm. you're audible a little bit past Lafayette, Indiana, so power's up. But you dropped out of the bottom.
I'm surprised. I think we went down to 100 watts, so that's a very small fraction of our normal daytime power.
Yeah, I'm into shortwave, and I've got a very small directional antenna on top of a radio that's no longer made, and it I can zone into your power spread easily. So that's the reason why I may be here, and other people around here may not. But anyway, I can hear you. My question deals with a couple of statements you made earlier, and I guess I'm coming at this from a certain amount of naivete, when you said that the Western economists said, well, you just didn't do it fast enough, so there's no way. Then you made the statement, there's no way really to check out whether it's right or wrong. We just have this. Somehow, intuitively, that sort of gets to me when you have millions of people, on the verge of starvation and all that kind of stuff. You sort of think, like, the president should have some responsibility for this. So I wonder what it is for you economists, what kind of experiment has to be done to say, oh, yeah, we made a mistake there, and stop hiding under from these and not other kinds of statements. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an economist, so I don't have to defend them. But in talking to a lot of economists, what they argue is that they work from comparative theory, first and foremost. And they don't like to complicate their theoretical models with too much on-the-ground information that is distinct to any given place. So, in fact, when economists were going to Russia, and I was talking to some of them who were involved, for example, in the IMF, about policies, and I was talking about what I knew from on the ground and the dangers and problems of social attitudes and all the reasons that this wouldn't work easily, if at all. This was in 91, 92, 93. The argument was, well, think about Peru or think about this reform in Africa. And there's a sense that there are carefully developed academic models, highly mathematical, that show why things work. So in a certain sense, when I said they have this I mean, you described it as intuitive or instinctive, and I described it earlier as a sort of ideology. It is grounded in a great deal of economic science that they find convincing. And then, like any scientist, this is an experiment. And when things don't go right, they feed the data back in and try to make new decisions. The problem is when you're a political figure, a president, or a member of parliament of a country, and things are happening very badly, you have no time for economic experiments. So American economists or other advisors can take a theoretical high ground because they're more concerned in a certain sense with, one might say this, maybe this is too cynical, with refining their theories than they are with the actual conditions of people on the ground. Other people have to worry about that. And they know the real world is messy, but they want to develop sophisticated theories that hopefully will get better through harsh experiments. They point out, for example, that shock therapy worked very well in Poland. Many Poles don't think so. But it appeared that in a smaller country with different economic traditions, it worked better. And they've drawn useful conclusions that their theories work better for countries like Poland than they work for countries like Russia.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go next talk with someone in Royal. This is line 3. Hello.
Professor, thank you for your thoughts. The reason I've been listening to some of the comments and some of the imagery associated with Russia, I guess it speaks for our ignorance and I guess our arrogancy when discussing Russia. You know, it's constantly described, you know, some sort of like a dark place. You know, we in the West versus Russia, is it still Asiatic? You know, many people don't understand how immense that country is to begin with, and it's just kind of, I guess it's our fault. We keep associating Russia with certain imagery of the Cold War, and it shows how ignorant we are in terms of understanding Russia. And it seems we can make up excuses why some of our policies fail there, but ultimately it comes down to Russia is its own country. So whether we like it or not, it's going to go its own way. And it's extremely offensive to some of the Russians that I know to be discussing in the same language that was used, let's say, 20 years ago. And so I was wondering, I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's all very, very insightful, actually. At an earlier point in the conversation where somebody said, energy is really the source, the greatest strength of Russia. And in fact, apropos of that, I would say it's not. I mean, in a certain economic sense, it obviously is. But there are enormous strengths in Russia that our stereotypes of them sometimes neglect. I mean, we think of, for example, for one thing, it's a highly urban and highly educated population. A typical engineer in Russia is likely to be conversant in many forms of music, probably plays an instrument. There's all sorts of orchestras of engineers and doctors and others. Is certainly going to speak a couple of foreign languages, usually quite well, read literatures in those languages. The most educated have access to the internet and read widely. Newspapers in Russia, unlike TV, which is very restricted, newspapers have a wide variety of very sophisticated essays because there's an audience for that. We think of Russian literature and we think of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Maybe we think of Solzhenitsyn, but in fact, the literary and artistic scenes are enormously exciting and vital right now. In other words, Russia is actually a country with an intelligent, sophisticated, highly competent population. If you know Russians in the United States, many working in the business world here in the computer world do very, very well, come with very high skills. So we forget actually about the human capital that Russia has when we think of the raw materials and natural resources. And it's interesting because Bush and Putin, President Bush and President Putin, have met on many occasions. And people make fun of Bush for his comment when he said after the first time meeting Putin that I got a sense of his soul. And Russians laughed hysterically because they're still trying to figure out Putin's soul. But what grew out of that were a series of comments by President Bush, current President Bush, that actually he understands a lot about Russia. And one of the things he said repeatedly is that Russia is a country with a rich tradition and a strong sense of pride and doesn't want to be treated as a secondary power. And his understanding that Russians are proud people and have a lot to be proud of is actually very important insight on his part and has affected our policy toward them in all sorts of ways.
Let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, do you think the Europeans or the United States would exert any kind of meaningful influence on the way Russia is prosecuting its war in the Northern Caucasus?
Hmm. Yes, and they have. In two senses, both positive and negative, there's been a lot of international concern that if Russia wants to be a member of the community of civilized nations, as some people call it, the community of European nations, they need to be cautious in how they pursue the war in Chechnya to avoid real atrocities. And in fact, the war has changed. Mass bombing and destruction of Grozny, which happened, to be sure, it was done. You don't have to repeat it, has been replaced by careful cultivation of Chechen friends. I mean, the current prime minister, Kadyrov, is remarkably friendly with Russia and in some ways is being supported by Russia. And so there's an attempt to rebuild the country and give a careful support to friends. In other words, to make it a less brutal and blatant war, although there are still some horrible cases of atrocities by troops in the field. The other side of it, though, which in which the West has an effect, is since September 11th, 2001, Russia suddenly had a new way to justify its war in Chechnya. And it is not the argument that Chechen was an independent republic that had the right to freedom and self-determination, which was the old argument, which was hard to deny. You can't, it's hard to make a case against self-determination. But the argument that Chechnya had become a haven for terrorists and Russia was, you know, Russia was one of the first countries, if not the first, to call the United States after September 11th and express outrage at the slaughter of innocent civilians, as Putin put it, and also immediately began to remind the world that, remember, we've been fighting the war on terrorism longer than you have, and we're happy to join with you. And don't be too harsh on what happens in Chechnya, because that is part of the war on terrorism. So in both senses, it's moderated the war, and they've tried to behave more carefully, but it also has added a justification for them to continue to ensure that Chechnya is controlled and doesn't become a haven for terrorists. Whether or not Chechnya was ever a haven for terrorists is a question not all people think is true that it was, but certainly it's given the Russian government new justification. So yes, we do influence how they behave in the human rights sphere.
Well, you know, they just executed some Russian diplomats in Baghdad.
Yes.
And they claimed that they were claiming some solidarity with the people in Chechnya. Does that concern you, or what do you think about that development? Or do you think that's just a spurious?
Well, you know, in a strange way, it shows how much Russia is really part of the alliance they want to be part of, opposing terrorism, rebuilding a strong state that is closely allied with the Western powers. And though Russia was, remember, very critical of the war in Iraq, joined Germany and France in opposing the war in Iraq for all sorts of reasons that are both self-serving in terms of their own interests, but also part of the alliance, they would rather be friends in some ways with the Germans than the Americans. They're closer to them and economically more tied up with Germany. Nonetheless, the attack on Russians, quite brutal, which has angered and frustrated many Russians, only reminds them of what they do believe in, which is that they are part of the Western world and that they're not going to back off their efforts to what they define as fighting terrorism, and also their efforts to keep Chechnya, to keep the boundaries of Russia where they are, not to allow it to change. So it won't make any change in policy
at
all.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Just to return for a moment to the relationship between Russia and the United States, I'm thinking about going back to May. Vice President Cheney made some pretty harsh comments about Russia, and in his State of the Nation speech, Mr. Putin responded. And the thing that I have seen in so many stories is this this Russian proverb he refers to about the wolf. Mm-hmm. He apparently said something like, "Comrade Wolf knows whom to eat, and he eats without listening to others." Now, he didn't, Mr. Putin didn't say, "And you know what? Who we're talking about here?" But everything that I read said clearly, oh, well, he was referring to the United States, and he was reacting specifically to some of these things that the vice president had said. And if you take a comment like that, and then you also set it aside, the thing that you said just a little bit ago about how there is this famously positive and pragmatic relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Bush, going back to the time when Mr. Bush said, well, this is, you know, I've looked in this man's eyes, and this is a man we can deal with. Well, you know, it just sort of makes you wonder exactly what the relationship between the two countries are. Clearly, the United States, it's in the best interest of both countries for the relationship to be positive, and the United States would like Russia to support us in what we call our war on terror, would like to have Russian support when it comes to our dealings with countries of the Middle East, like Iran, when it comes to our concerns about North Korea and its nuclear program. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why we would say we would like to have Russia on board with our policy. What exactly can one say about currently what's the state of the relations between the two countries?
The single word answer is ambivalent. In the sense that, on the one hand, one finds this, as I've said, this desire to be seen as part of the Western alliance, which includes especially the European countries and the United States, and to assist in anything that they consider to be in their interests. I mean, they're very conscious you don't act out of your own. You only act out of national interest, but national interest of Russia is to be part of the Western world and all it represents for economic reasons, among others. The example of Iran is a very good one because the Russians played a very active role in trying to find solutions to the nuclear enrichment problem. You know, do it in Russia. They made numerous offers, most of which didn't succeed in the end, and they haven't stopped. The notion is we can be helpful to you. We can do things you can't do yourself, but we're part of your team, as it were. But the other side of that is a very strong sense of national pride. And so when I say they only act out of their own interests, so do we. I mean, most countries in the world think that way, and that's considered rational political behavior. For Russians, that's certainly true, but it goes even further. Given the fact that many have called the Russia today the effect of a humiliated empire. If one thinks of the Soviet Union as the continuation of the Russian Empire, they've lost much of that space that had been gained not in Soviet times, but in the 18th century and early 19th century. They have been weakened in the eyes of the world in terms of their stature and their space. And the desire to sort of reclaim a sense of being recognized as a major power in the world has resulted in a sort of response to the loss of the Soviet Union as a very strong sense of nationalism. Nationalism in the sense of we have a great history, we are a powerful country to be dealt with respect, we will act in ways that are independent of other countries. And Putin, you can see it in his rhetoric all the time. You can see it in his references to the Soviet past as nothing to be embarrassed about, or at least rather, there are moments not to be embarrassed about. We should be proud of every good thing in our history and, of course, admit the bad things, but spend less time dwelling on it. Russia will continue to act in both ways. They'll act in the direction of wanting to show that they're part of our alliance of the Western world, and they'll want to act in ways that visibly remind us, but just as much the Russian population, is they're not a lapdog of anybody, that they're an independent power with its own traditions and will periodically act in ways just to show, one might say, just to show that they can act independently. And part of Putin's popularity is that he does both. He is neither hostile to the West, nor does he sort of kowtow to everything.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Steinberg. He's professor of history at the University of Illinois. Russia, his specialty. We're talking about current events in Russia, and we have about 7-8 minutes left. We have another caller here to bring in to the conversation. Someone in Charleston. That's line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just returned from Russia a week ago.
Great.
And had a terrific time. And one of my observations about Russia is when you mentioned the middle class is that I don't think people really understand what that means, because I see my experience is that it's a country of either or polar opposites, that people either have a lot of money or they have very little, if any money. And the idea of the middle class is their middle class would probably be much like our lower middle class, in the sense that they just don't have much to spend. There isn't a lot of money to spend. And yet, you're right about the stores. I was amazed at, we call this, one of us referred to their grocery store as the Russian Walmart. They had everything you could possibly want, and the fruit was very fresh, vegetables fresh. They had candy from Switzerland, from Germany, and so on. I mean, just anything you would want was in the store. Yet there are many people who can't possibly afford to buy in quantities. You know, they might be able to buy a little bit, but they can't buy a lot. We were at a conference with other Russian professors, and some of them make $200 a month as a professor, which to me is just unbelievable. And as you said, they have other jobs. We've talked to people who have driven taxis on the weekend to make extra money. So it really is. It's like we, in the United States, I think that we have a growing gap between the upper class and the lower class, that we have fewer in between than we used to. But it was remarkable, I think, in Russia.
Yeah, there's a sort of rule of thumb that some have used, and I always use when I'm in Russia, is when you see something in the store, multiply it by 10 and imagine whether you could afford it. If you have an American income.
Yes.
And I'm a professor, so it's not the highest of American incomes.
Right.
And so that is that, because the prices tend to be very close to our prices and their income tends to be about a tenth, if you calculate the fact that rent is very low for various reasons, that utilities are fairly low. There's various certain food products are very inexpensive. Some are very expensive. Mm-hmm. So that sort of works. And then you begin to be shocked. How does anybody afford it at all?
Right.
And the answer really is partly working multiple jobs, but also partly making very careful consumer choices.
Mm-hmm.
Russians save. They think about a purchase. They don't throw things away. They fix them. They're very judicious. They don't have the freedom to walk in a store and say, I'd like that and I'd like that.
Right.
They think about it for a long time. And so it's a painful process for people in the middle. The poor, in a certain sense, really suffer.
Right.
They don't even worry about those choices. The other thing I'd say is you probably were in Moscow, right?
No,
or
actually,
Petersburg?
I was in Moscow 2 years ago,
yeah.
And this was St. Petersburg.
This was St. Petersburg, which has improved a lot in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to a small town out in the heart of the country, even a provincial capital like Yaroslavl, for example, things are much different. Though the amazing thing is they're beginning to change. 5 years ago, you'd go to a town like Yaroslavl and find very little. Now you begin to find more and more. So the economy and the ability of creating this very small and very tenuous and rather painfully purchasing middle class is actually beginning to expand. But when you get out to small towns and then especially out in the countryside, where a sizable part of the population lives with real, real poverty. So Moscow and Petersburg are really quite exceptional.
Well,
in that sense, but a good sign, one might argue, of where other cities seem to be moving.
And that was nice that with our conference, there were Russian professors from across Russia. So it was they weren't just from St. Petersburg
right.
or Moscow. The thing, again, Americans sometimes just don't get it. Several of the people with us, there are about 30 Americans, were complaining because they heard that the Russians paid a different hotel rate than the Americans.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just want to slap them and say, you know, okay, if you paid $60, if they paid $60, that would be a month's rent to stay for 4 days.
Right.
You know, and for us, $60, we don't even have to think about that.
Right. And in a big city like Moscow or St. Petersburg, $60 is not bad for a hotel for us.
Right.
Exactly. But it's very painful for them. No, you were right to slap them or to think of slapping them.
Exactly. And the other thing I just wanted to throw in quickly is I was thrilled to find out what a great sense of humor our Russian colleagues have.
Yeah.
We were, you know, you just, again, some people talk about it being dark and blah, blah, blah. And they were just hysterical. They had a fabulous sense of humor. So it was really fun.
The other thing that Russians are famous for, and is true even in the darkest days of Soviet times, is hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
Russians love to entertain and will still to this day, but even in Soviet times, make enormous efforts to go and get very scarce goods in order to have enough on the table to look like a party.
Mm-hmm.
And Russians are very, very warm people. I mean, one of the anecdotal sides is that is every time you get groups of scholars going over to do research, graduate students to do their dissertation work, a fair number of them come back married. It's a very warm place.
I must jump in here because we've come to the end of the time, and we're going to have to say thanks to the callers and also thanks to our guest, Mark Steinberg. He is professor of history here at University of Illinois, also former director of the Russia and East European Center at the U of I. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.